All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and let's continue on here. Let's wrap up these two verses and get on with the rest of it. We left off here dealing with verses 30 and 31. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Which is, and clearly, and I didn't bring it out in here, but I don't think there should be any question, but what when you read this, that this is clearly a limiting factor. That's what it's designed to be. This generation will not pass away. There's a limit to it. Until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. And we were down, we finished up point 23 there. From man's perspective, the heavens and the earth appear to be eternal, but statements such as this make it evident that they are not. 24, although some have suggested that Jesus is not actually contemplating the passing away of the heavens and the earth, that is exactly what he's talking about. And there are a number of places that predict the destruction of the current material universe. And it will come to pass just prior to the great white throne judgment. Psalm 102, 25 and 26. Of old you founded the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Even they will perish, but you endure. All of them will wear out like a garment. Like clothing you will change them, and they will be changed, but you are the same, and your years will not come to an end. Isaiah 51:6 also. Lift up your eyes to the sky. Then look to the earth beneath. For the sky will vanish like smoke. And the earth will wear out like a garment, and its inhabitants will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever. And my righteousness will not wane. Isaiah 65:17. So again, a careful reading of Jesus is not offering any, quote, new information here about the destruction of the heavens and the earth, or how that'll all come to pass. He's just saying it's going to happen. That heaven and earth are going to pass. 65:17, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former things will not be remembered or come to mind. And then 66:22, for just as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, will endure before me. Well, when he talks about making a new heavens and a new earth, I mean, without saying it, it's pretty clear that the first heavens and the first earth have gone. They're passed away. Somehow they've been replaced with a better situation, a new one. 66:22, just as the new heavens and the new earth, which I will make, will endure before me, declares the Lord. So your offspring and your name will endure. Also, 2 Peter 3:13. Now, this actually, 2 Peter here, this little verse provides us the mechanic by which God is going to do this. 2 Peter 3:13, actually 12. Looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be destroyed by burning, and the elements will melt with intense heat. But according to his promise, we are looking for new heavens and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. And then, of course, as typical, both Paul, Peter, many of the apostles, in all their writings, they will make these theological assertions. And then immediately draw a theological conclusion for phase two off of it. Therefore, based on the fact that this is all going to be passing away, you be diligent to found in him in peace, spotless and blameless. The believer has things to work on. And then Revelation 21:1, here we see in the concluding book the actual events about which we're talking. And actually, if you'll back up to chapter 20, verse 11, you can put that in there. Well, actually, we're going to cover that in the next point, but we'll look at it here now, so I've got it in the next point. I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. Now, again, it doesn't give us the mechanics. It just says heaven and earth disappear, and we're not told how or why. But they do. Now we know the mechanic is intense heat. It's a heat that will make the elements, will actually destroy them. And again, from man's perspective, a science understands we can neither create nor destroy matter. That is not true of God. God can create and destroy matter. And then 21:1, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. Now, one of the things we do know, and again, here is where you have to make some presumptions. It seems to me that when Jesus died, was killed, murdered, and then resurrected, in his resurrection body, did Jesus materially look or seem any really different than he did in his physical body? Or was his resurrection body very much patterned off of his physical body? He still had the scars. He still had the holes in his side, and the wounds were there, apparently visible, because he tells that to Thomas. Hey, you don't want to believe until you see? Hey, check this out. And, of course, then you feel like an idiot because you've challenged the Lord, and now he's publicly rebuked you. And but Jesus wasn't a 5'6" Jew before the resurrection and an 8-foot-tall minute bull after. How would they have recognized him? They wouldn't have. So the point is, it seems to me that our resurrection bodies will very much be patterned after the current physical body. Obviously, there may be changes, and there's going to be differences in glory and differences in the way we appear. But my sense is we'll know each other because obviously, I think everybody in heaven will know each other. But we all can't look the same. I mean, any sort of weird idea, we're going to be conformed to the image of Christ. We're all going to be looking like Jesus, 33-year-old males, or 36, however old he was when he died, 36, I think, running around in heaven identical. That's not it. Well, I would presume, because of what I know from that, I would make the extension to, well, the new heavens and the new earth are probably patterned off of the first heavens and the first earth. That would make some sense. Now, will there be some differences? Maybe, but we're not told. And the fact that we're not told makes dogmatism absolutely stupid. To be dogmatic about something you don't know is the height of stupidity. And so the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there is no longer any sea. Now, what we do know is, let's assume that the earth is modeled after this present earth. The one thing that will be absolutely different is that it will be entirely inhabitable. That there will be, everything will be gone. There will be no seas. It will be in one solid landmass. Now, obviously, this doesn't address the matter of fresh water and other factors. We know that the river of life comes flowing out of the throne and out of that holy city. And so how this all works, mechanically, well, we don't know. And we just have to wait and see. But presuming that the new earth and the new heavens are fashioned off of the first earth and the first heavens, what we do have is a fixed, finite universe once again. However, whatever form it may be in. And so you can easily calculate sizes and things. I mean, for instance, we can calculate if all the earth was landmass, all we have to do is calculate the external issue, the landmass of a sphere. Then there's a mathematical formula. It's 4 pi r squared, I believe. Gives you the surface area of a sphere. So if we know the radius of the earth, we do. Let's assume the new earth is twice as big. It's still patterned off the first earth, but twice as big. You can still calculate it by, well, then you'll double the radius, and then it's still 4 pi r squared. Gives you the surface area of that sphere. And so then we can start calculating, okay, well, how many people could this hold? I never have had the impression, I've never been to heaven, I haven't seen it. Haven't seen the new heavens and the new earth. But I've never had the impression that it's going to be small. I've always had the impression, my general instincts are, that this is all big, this is all magnificent. These are on grandiose scales. And that's based on things like, look, the new Jerusalem coming down out of heaven. And it's a 1,500-mile cube, apparently. It's either a cube or some will also have it as a pyramid-type structure. But what we do know is it's 1,500 miles, essentially half the width of the U.S. and the breadth of it,
cubed.
And it's either, again, it comes up as, you know, if it comes up as a straight cube or if it comes up as a pyramid. That somebody gets to live in the penthouse there. I don't know. But if that's just one city and it's that big, I would get the impression that this is all pretty grandiose. And when you see, when you look at the description of that city, in verse 12 of this chapter, it had a great and high wall. This city comes down having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, verse 11, of crystal clear jasper. And, you know, he's got to give Mark, John, has to give information in his frame of reference. He can't come up with new stuff to describe this. He can only describe what he's seeing in terms of what he knows. And it had a great and high wall with 12 gates. And at the gates, 12 angels. And names were written on them, which are the names of the 12 tribes of the son of Israel. And then they had foundation stones on which were the 12 names of the 12. If there's 12 foundation stones on a 1,500 mile cube city, how big are those foundation stones? Well, you can quickly calculate that out mathematically. They're huge. These foundation stones have to be massive. And then he has him measure it. He said the city is laid out as a square. I like that about cities. Cities are laid out as squares. They're easy to navigate. You never get lost. If the city's laid out as a square, you couldn't get lost. It'd be hard to. You could figure out which direction you were going and just, you know, you'd know where to go. So I like that. And he measured the city with a rod 1,500 miles. Its length and width and height are equal. And he measured its wall 72 yards according to human measurements, which are also angelic measurements. In other words, the angels don't appear to use a different system of measuring, a different system of this or that than men use. Whatever the angelic language is, I would predict that men will be able to understand them. And it'll be a language that, you know, we're all probably going to speak the same language in heaven. I have no idea what it'll be. We presume English, but I don't know. And then you get this beautiful description of the city and how it's laid out. And so all of this is very grandiose and very huge, very magnificent. But for all this to come, the material universe has to go. This earth has to go. It's all got to be done. Got to be wiped out. Well, 26, the destruction of the physical universe will occur suddenly. And the very elements of which the creation is formed will be destroyed. This is referred to in poetic language in the book of Revelation. That was the 2011. Heaven and earth fled away. It's like the glory of God, the guy sitting on the throne, is so great that the physical creation is ashamed to be in his presence. And they run away. It's just poetic language. It doesn't mean they do. It's referring to the destruction of these things. In 27, the emphasis here is on the fact that from man's perspective, the heavens and the earth are the most stable and permanent fixtures of which he is aware. However, the word of God and the word of Christ are far more enduring. They are going to outlive all of this. They will survive the entirety. And verse 32 now, but of that day and that hour, no one knows. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Concerning what? This is the question. Concerning that day. What day? What day are we talking about? This becomes the first theological grammatical thing you have to address. Now, or you got a mild adversative, duh here, and then you have the preposition peri with the genitive of heimera, but concerning the day, and then the remote demonstrative pronoun ekainos, E-K-E-I-N-O-S, concerning that day, or conjunction here, this looks like an E in the Greek, that's all you would see there, E-A, or the hour, that day or the hour. Hora is the term, Greek term, H-O-R-A for hour. No one. Negative compound here, udais, comes from the negative u, and the number one, not one, no one, knows. Perfect active indicative. Oida is always used in the perfect in the Greek, because once you know something, you know it. There's existing results. If you learn something, you know it. Now, you may forget it later on down the road, but essentially, once you know something, we kind of view it as you know it. Do you know your name? Yeah, well, you kind of always know your name, hopefully. So no one knows. Coordinating conjunction here, udeh, neither the angels, angelos, the root meaning here of angelos, A-N-G-E-L-O-S, is that of a messenger. Context must determine, because it's not a technical term, it can be used of human messengers and angelic messengers, and you have to let the context speak for itself. And in this case, you can translate it as nothing but angels. The angels in heaven. Preposition in plus uranos. So, neither the angels in heaven, nor, udeh again, the Son, clearly, hohuios, H-U-I-O-S, neither the Son, and clearly, that by context, in verse 26, the closest antecedent is they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds. And so the Son, contextually, it would have to refer back to that same Son. We don't have any other Son that we know about that would be talking here. So he's talking about himself. Neither the Son, and then you have, but the Father alone is actually, you have a conjunction, I may, which means if not, literally, except or unless. No one knows except the Father. And they've translated this, but the Father alone. But the whole point of this is, no one knows except the Father. That's how the sentence runs. I mean, the rest of it just provides you information. Not the angels don't know. The Son doesn't know. The only one that knows is the Father. So point one, this verse, and you think, well, this seems pretty straightforward and easy. Oh, it is. Except it creates a lot of theological problems. This verse has been one of the most controversial passages in the New Testament since the earliest portions of the church age. The obvious reason is that it has a direct impact on the matter of Christology. Christology is the study of Christ, His person, His work. And understanding all the things related to the Son of God. And this includes His pre-incarnate deity. This includes the pre-incarnate deity becoming humanity. This includes the whole person in the hypostatic union. And this includes all the things about His life and His person and His work. This includes things like His sinless nature. This includes His work for sins and all these other matters. And two, nothing has changed over the years. As Taylor has referred to this as one of the unsolved problems of New Testament exegesis. While Ralph Martin said that the verse has been an exegetical embarrassment from the beginning. Pretty strong words for a guy that doesn't understand what it says. I think what he meant to say is, I'm embarrassed that I can't interpret it. That's what he should have said. But he didn't. He wants to blame the verse, not him. So when interpreters can't interpret, either through lack of exegesis, lack of skills, lack of theological grid, well, they got to blame the verse. Who else are you going to blame? Can't blame them. Well, three, the problem is the reality that any real lack of knowledge on the part of the Son was so offensive to early Christian writers that a number of attempts were made either to dismiss the idea of the Son's ignorance completely or to reinterpret it in some sort of symbolic fashion. And four, such is still true today. For Jesus to assert His ignorance on a subject of such critical theological importance as the timing of His own coming strikes many as something that is not in harmony with His status as the Son of God. In other words, their view is, how could He not know this? How could He not understand all this? I mean, He's teaching about it, but He freely asserts here that, as He says, nobody knows. Heaven and earth will pass away, but nobody knows the hour. Nobody's really got this all figured out and pinpointed down. And to my thinking, when I look at this verse, what is this telling me? You're not going to know. That's what this verse says. You're not going to know. It's planned ignorance on the part of God for believers with regard to certain things. Now, could God reveal all truth to us at all the time? Sure, He could. He could. Number one, would you have the capacity to absorb it? And the answer is probably no. But he doesn't choose to do this. This is the important thing. That there are things where God says, you know, you don't need to know this. There's a verse in the Old Testament, I don't remember where it was, but he says, the things that have been revealed are for us and our sons forever, but the hidden things belong to the Lord God. Well, he freely acknowledges in the Old Testament there are hidden things. There are things that Moses didn't know, David didn't know, Solomon didn't know. Now, here we got a problem, because now we got something Jesus didn't know. Well, then isn't Jesus omniscient in his deity? Well, certainly he is. Well, how could he assert ignorance? Well, that ignorance could only be true of his humanity. That's the first thing and the easiest step to make here. Ignorance could only be true of humanity. It could never be true of deity. Because if God knows all things, if God has omniscience, if God has foreknowledge, then his omniscience extends to everything. He could write a book with the name of every positive believer in it in eternity past, and that book has never changed and never will change. And demonstrates that he knew the end from the beginning. So let's say he wrote this book 10,000 years ago. Who's the last positive believer born?
I don't know.
But his name's in that book. There's going to be a last name in that book. Now, whether they're done alphabetically or chronologically, I mean, he could have written the book either way. People write books in different ways to suit their purpose. So if God wrote the names alphabetically or chronologically, chronologically makes sense that he would list them in the order in which they occurred in human history. Well, there's that last positive believer. And 10,000 years before he was born, God put his name down and said, this guy's going to be positive. Well, that demonstrates foreknowledge. Very clearly demonstrates God knows the end from the beginning. So, if that's true in his deity, this really is a problem because, well, doesn't the Son of God possess deity? Yes, he does. And we'll get into this matter of the nature of the Son of God, his real actual nature. That's the fundamental thing you have to understand. Because he is deity and humanity, he possesses the qualities of both. But one of the rules of the incarnation was he could not give free expression to his deity at all times. Deity had to limit itself. I mean, number one, if he gave expression to his deity at all times, he dwells in light which no man can approach, whom no man has seen or can see. So when you hear these people, oh, I saw the Lord. No, you didn't. If you saw the Lord, it would be like what happened in that Indiana Jones movie. When they opened up the ark, you just melt on your feet. And that was so cool. The glory of God just killed those people. And that was probably as good a rendition as anything I'd ever seen. They just look on this glory and suddenly they melt. Their bodies just disintegrate. Well, that's what would happen if you saw the Lord. So clearly, he cannot give expression to his full... I mean, it'd be easy to pick out the Messiah if he glowed. How do you know who the Messiah is? He's that glowing guy over there. See him? You can see him really well at night. Or if he was like 12 feet tall. Which one's the Messiah? It's that big guy up there. Or if he had some great identifying characteristics. Well, in his deity, he had to put some of this stuff aside. That's part of the deal of the incarnation. Well, again, so some say that for Jesus to assert his ignorance is something that really scares them and worries them. See, I look at it and I'm not scared or worried. Do I seem scared? Controlled fear. No, I'm not scared. It doesn't bother me. I mean, look, just... You just got to figure out what's going on. That's the big deal. And that's always the prayer of the exegete. I don't care what the text says, Lord. I just want to know what it says. I just want to understand it. Well, five, the most definitive doctrinal statement on the person of Jesus Christ is found in the Chalcedonian Creed, which was formulated at the Fourth Ecumenical Council. And in many ways, in the ancient course of church history, the way these issues were addressed was that believers would come together. They would have these assemblies in which they would debate theological issues. And very often, these assemblies were nothing more than a response to some sort of heresy that was being promoted. You had various heretics out there who would promote various false doctrines, and believers would come together and say, how can we combat this? What is the truth here? And they would spend time working out these theological issues. And that's great. I mean, and that's what we have here. So the Council at Chalcedon in 451 AD affirmed the unity of Jesus' person. In other words, we're talking about a single person that has a dual nature. But he's a unified whole, just like you're a unified whole. As a believer now, you possess two distinct natures. You've got a spiritual nature and you've got a fleshly nature. But no, you never think of yourself as two different people. But we certainly see, you know, you start reading Paul there in Romans 7. And you see this great dichotomy that exists. And at some points in our existence, because I can see it in Paul and I see it in my own experience, you can almost get the sense that you are two people. You are conflicted on a number of levels sometimes. All of us are. Because of the war between the flesh and the spirit. You have two distinct natures that exist within you. And so do I, and so did Jesus. Now, his second nature was full on deity. Ours is just eternal life. We have the human spirit. But we didn't become God. Whereas he was God in his very essence. And God in his very essence joined up with a perfect humanity. And this is what the incarnation is all about. Well, the council affirmed the unity of Jesus' person, the duality of his natures, and his identity with the divine substance. B, the conclusion, which has been called the Chalcedonian Box, stated that four factors need to be balanced in order to have an accurate understanding of the person of Christ. And C, these four considerations include his deity, his humanity, the unity of one person, and the distinction between the two natures. Now, all of these things, according to the Chalcedonian Council, have to be in place in order to be orthodox. Any deviation beyond this, you have now moved out of the bounds of orthodox Christianity. You have gone into something else. For instance, if you read information that the Mormons put forth about Jesus and who he actually is, you'll find that it's completely wrong. The Jehovah's Witness, completely wrong. Many theological organizations out there, not just cults, are wrong because they do not understand. I know as a Southern Baptist, it was taught to me, the way it was taught to me is that the body was just simply a shell and deity ran everything. But that's not true. That's not true. I mean, it might seem that way. And so therefore, Jesus could not sin because deity was always making the choices. Well, but wait a second. Is that true even? And you can prove from the scriptures, nope, that's not true. So you have two distinct natures. And Jesus is conscious in himself that he has these two distinct natures. He knows this. And one time he may speak from one nature. Who has ascended into heaven but the Son of Man, the one who came down from heaven. Well, that's only true of deity. That's not true of his humanity. Then when he's on the cross and he says, I thirst. That's true only of his humanity. That's not true of his deity. And we talked about the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. God doesn't get tired. That's only true of deity. Deity needs to sleep. Jesus was in the boat sleeping. Do you think it was his deity that was asleep or his humanity? But I would suggest to you that while his humanity was asleep, while his deity was there, it wasn't doing anything. He was letting the humanity of Jesus rest. Because he had to have rest. I mean, he's physical. He's got these limitations. So, these four things, you've got to keep these things straight. And six, the discussion certainly does focus on the very important matter of how the interpreter is to understand the title, the Son, which some desire to apply to his humanity, some to his deity, and some to the whole person. Some, like Dom, state that when the title Son is used, it absolutely indicates that the deity of Christ is in view. That's from the Journal of the Evangelical Theological Society. But just because he says this, again, he asserts it, but does he prove it? No, he doesn't. He just makes this assertion. Others see the use of the title Son referring to his humanity, based on the use of the title Son of Man. And we certainly know that Son of Man was a title that Jesus used exclusively almost of himself. And we know that that title was derived from the Daniel 13 issue. And this heavenly figure called the Son of Man. But this is dealing with the glorified hypostasis now that receives this kingdom. So the Son of Man there refers to Jesus after his glorification. As now he can give expression to his deity. That he's not bound by these limitations anymore of the incarnation. Well, seven, while it is true that Jesus Christ was the Son of God in his deity and in his humanity and thus in his whole person, the imputation of ignorance to him is exceedingly troubling to those that cannot harmonize his ignorance with their theological grid. And that really forms the basis of the problem. Their theological grid is faulty. Because here's this challenging verse, and they say, we can't work it into our grid. I say, you must work it into your grid. It has to be addressed. So, eight, the primary ways theologians have attempted to deal with this issue fall into several categories, ranging from doctrines that uphold the Chalcedonian understanding to doctrines that undermine the Orthodox position. And A, the first position is that of the hypostatic union, which acknowledges that Jesus Christ had two distinct natures, deity and humanity, and that when either of these natures acted, the whole person acted. You can put a T besides that one. That one's true. That's true. That at least addresses the two natures, and that if he was acting from his deity, obviously he had to do it through his humanity. His deity wasn't free to just go off and do stuff apart from his humanity. They were bound together inextricably, and internally, even more important. Well, B, this view states that the Logos, and that's the term used of him in John 1, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word. And the Word was with God, i.e., alongside God, face to face with God, and the Word was God. So he's distinct from God, and he's God at the same time. This is what we learn in John 1:1, simple, basic theology 101 Christology. The Word existed, pre-existed as God, the second person of the Godhead. Why is he called the Word? Well, Word is a perfect word to use for the Son. Because what does a word do? A word communicates a concept. And words make tangible to us that which is often abstract. And so when we talk about the concept of the Son of God, what do we mean by that? When we talk about deity, God himself, why would we use the word word? Because the word, the Son of God, was the expression of God. If one wants to see God and how he acts, study the Son. Because the Son is equally God. And in his humanity, he has to, as we know, be obedient. So the view states that his Logos, his divine nature, knew the time of his return. But that information was kept from his humanity by his divine nature. That you mark T by that one too. That's true. In his deity, if you want to ascribe ignorance to deity, go ahead. I'm not going to. I'm going to presume that when God says, I know all things, that he actually knows all things. So in his deity, sure, he knew. But did his deity always refer every bit of information back to his humanity? No. Why would he? I mean, you would overwhelm any person with that. I don't care if it was the Son of God. You would overwhelm a person with all that information. So his deity didn't always tell his humanity everything. He didn't have to. Why would he? Jesus in his humanity only needs a limited amount of information in order to fulfill his niche, correct? So whatever limited amount he needed, now he needed more than most, but it was still not, he didn't need infinite information to fulfill his life here on the planet. And neither did John the Baptist say. And so, again, for his humanity to be not knowledgeable about something, I'm sure he was ignorant of quite a few things in his humanity. Did he remember his birth? Did you remember yours? No, I doubt that he remembered his. He was not given, you know, just a bunch of things that the rest of us as normal humans weren't given. He had to be subject to the limitations of true humanity and all that means. Did Jesus know a year and a half that he was that the deity resided within his consciousness? No, I doubt it. At a year and a half, how much did you know? And I doubt you could figure out you were the Son of God. And so Jesus had to grow into this. Why do we know this? Well, we got a verse, I think it's in Luke there, where it says he kept growing in wisdom and in stature. In other words, was Jesus born full-sized? No. He was born as a baby in a feeding trough in a barn. That's where he was born. And I assume in standard-sized baby, you know, whatever it is, 7 pounds, 12 ounces, I don't know, whatever he was. But they didn't measure it probably that night. Hey, do you want to know how much the baby weighs? And mom would say, no, who cares? So, and again, she's giving birth under, you know, less than ideal circumstances. This is not a fun place to be giving birth. You talk about unsanitary. They're in a barn. Well, I kind of know what goes on in there. See, a second solution that has been proposed is the, quote, official ignorance view. Now, this simply states that Jesus Christ knew the time of his return, but could not communicate it. And a corollary to this view, obviously, is that the Holy Spirit knows the time but can't communicate it either. That one's false. The official ignorance view is false. That one can't fly. Because that makes Jesus a liar. If he says, I don't know, and he really does know, he's a liar. That's just basic logic. And indeed, this view has an ancient history. Circa 300 AD was the position of Augustine, but is a minority view today, ostensibly held by Lewis Sperry Schaeffer and Shedd. I couldn't track down for certain that these are their views, but these are propounded as advocates of this view. The third view is that of the kenosis, which indicates that Jesus Christ willingly emptied himself of his divine nature when he became incarnate. Variations on this consist of the idea that he gave up all the attributes of God, that he limited voluntarily the use of the attributes, still had them but limited them, that he acted as if he did not have them, just pretended he didn't have them. Okay, I'm God, but I'm going to pretend I'm not. Well, what? And he voluntarily, he didn't have them, or that he completely laid aside his deity, that he's not even God at all. Which was then restored to him at the ascension. So his deity is taken away from him for a while, but then it's given back to him. I don't know how you do that. The mechanics of that one have to be rough. Well, the kenosis view is partially true. And the true part of the kenosis view is that he voluntarily limited the use of the divine attributes, even though he still possessed all of them. As God, he possessed all the attributes of deity. The fullness of the Godhead dwelt within that man, Jesus, bodily. That's Colossians 1. And so, the third view, kenosis, part of it's true. And it's the part where he had the attributes of God. He was still omniscient, omnipotent, omnipresent, all those things. But he limited the use of them. Obviously, in his deity, he could be anywhere at any time in his deity. In his humanity, he was bound by the time-space continuum and could only be in one place at one time. And he's still limited to that in the glorified hypostatic union. He still can only be in one place at one time. That's why we have to wait for his coming. Wherever he is, he's got to come. Well, we know where he is. He's at the right hand of God, sitting at the right hand of the throne, while God makes his enemies a footstool. Well, F, a final view is relatively recent, but is that of open theism, which essentially states that although God is omniscient, he does not know what will take place in the future. Since the future is not definitively fixed. Okay, wrong. That one's big ass wrong. Mark that one wrong. That one's no good. Because to posit omniscience and then say, well, he doesn't know, it's a violation of what omniscience means. I mean, it just takes the meaning away from the word. Well, 9, some of the theological problems are obvious in these views. For instance, the second view must be rejected by Orthodox interpreters since it makes Jesus Christ a liar. That's the official ignorance view. As I told you, that one's wrong. That's no good. He said he did not know about the time of his coming, but he really did. Well, that's a lie then. If you know something, you say you don't know it, that's what we call a lie. It's a pretty deep subject to really fathom, the lie. We all know what lying is. Well, 10, the open theism view is ludicrous on the surface. To posit, as the Bible does, an omniscient God, Isaiah 46, who possesses foreknowledge and then to state that he does not know the future is theological insanity. I mean, that one, I don't think you'd even need a pastor to tell you that that view is kind of messed up. Either you know or you don't know. I mean, you can't have it both ways. Either you know or you don't know. Isaiah 46, 9 and 10. Remember the former things long past, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me. Declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times. Declaring from ancient times things which had not been done. Saying, my purpose will be established and I will accomplish all my good pleasure. Truly, verse 11, I have spoken. Truly, I will bring it to pass. I have planned it. I will do it. Now, in what way does a plan not refer to the future? I mean, the very idea of the use of the word plan implies a future. And God, again, to posit a God that knows everything but then doesn't know this, well, that's just dumb. Acts 2:23 is one in which he asserts his, well, actually Peter does here, asserts not only omniscience but foreknowledge. See, God knew what everybody would do. All these people that play these little parts. And when we get into chapter 14, we start seeing, we've kind of seen them a little bit in the book. But as we get down to the end, think about all the little details that have to come together for this to all happen according to God's plan. All the players that have to play their part. Starting with Judas, the unbeliever who's going to betray him. He's got to go out and play that part. And so theologians want to say, oh, poor Judas, he couldn't help it. It was God's plan. No, wrong, wrong, wrong. These are all Judas' decisions. And then all the other guys have to play their part. The apostles have to abandon him, run off. The theological enemies, the religious establishment, they've got to all play their part. They've got to do what they got to do. Up to and including bribing Judas. Although they didn't bribe him as much as he went to them and said, give me some money and I'll do it. You know, I'll turn him over to you. And then you have this woman, and we know it's Mary, who comes in and anoints him before his burial there in Bethany on that Sunday when they had that big dinner party. And she comes in and anoints him, and then the disciples carp about it and complain, why was this perfume wasted? Could have been sold and given to the poor. And Jesus said, shut up and leave her alone. I love that one. So Acts 2:23, this man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. Now here Peter freely asserts that God's plan was thought out, it was predetermined, and that he knew about it ahead of time. But who did it? You nailed to a cross. God didn't do it, you did it. Just because God's plan knew it would occur, you're not absolved of your responsibility for what you do. This is why we are strict volitionalists. It is your volition that's going to determine what you end up with, what you become in God's plan. It's your choices. There's a particular group I like to listen to from time to time. I can't remember the name. It's something in the Believers. But one of their lines in one of their songs I really like is that, do you make decisions or do they make you? Both. You do make decisions, and they do determine the course of your destiny. They do determine where your history is going to go. Good decisions can lead to good outcomes. Bad decisions, as we know, lead to bad outcomes. And so, he says here, look, God knew about it, but you did it. And they got all this. I mean, they're picking up, they're hearing all this. And I mean, this is just galling them to no end. That Peter is putting this on them. You nailed to the cross by the hands of godless men. The intermediate means you used was Pilate. But I know what you did. You men manipulated this. You conspired against this man and had him killed. And we are going to put the blame right on you. And of course, they didn't care for this. They're not a big fan of his teaching, as you might imagine. And then 1 Peter 1:2 also. And that's our verse that essentially documents our position with respect to the fact that election is based on foreknowledge. That God knows ahead of time who the elect are because he already knows. Elect who are chosen, as it says in the end of verse 1, according to the foreknowledge of God. So he could choose out all the positive believers in all of history, and he knew who they were, but he doesn't know the time of his own coming. God does. God knows everything. There isn't. You can't have a position where God knows everything, but he doesn't know this one thing. Okay, so that one doesn't work. See, 3, or 11 here rather, the kenosis view and the hypostatic union view are correct, but each must be accurately defined, since there are differing views of what kenosis actually means. A, some say he gave up the use of the attributes. B, some say he acted as if he didn't possess them. C, some say he gave up the independent exercise of the attributes. In other words, he still had them, knew he had them, but could only tap into them as the will of God arose. He was limited by what the will of God was for his life, and so therefore the will of God was not to tap into deity. For instance, when Satan says, if you're the Son of God, command these stones, because he knew Jesus was hungry. And this gets into the angelic conflict and our enemies and how much they know about us, and they know when to strike. They watch us. They observe us. Stronger, smarter than us, more experienced, more dangerous, more deadly in every way. They're out to neutralize you, to kill you, to change your thinking so that you reject doctrines. Because as the church applies and embraces doctrine, not only is it a pillar and support of the truth, But according to Ephesians 3:10, God is using the church to make manifest the proof of His wisdom to those powers in the heavenly places. God is using the church to vindicate His actions, to vindicate His condemnation of Satan, to vindicate everything about His plan. And so what does Satan want? What do the demons want? They want to get into your thinking, and they want to convince you that, nah, you don't have to think this. Nah, that one's okay. You can go that way. I'll be fine. And all they've got to do is get a foothold. And of course, we've been taught forever and ever, believers can't be demon-possessed. No, not fully possessed, they can't. But there's no such word of demon possession in the Bible anyway. The word is always demonized. And there are various levels of that, up to and including what we would call full possession. But you got believers that are influenced by demons. And that's clear. Paul says, hey, there are certain believers that have been taken captive by Satan to do his will. So all they want to do is neutralize the plan of God by proving, nope, doctrine isn't true. Nope, doctrine doesn't work. You can blow this doctrine off. You can blow that doctrine off. And that's how they get into your head. And that's their plan. And we better not be ignorant of these schemes. So again, here Jesus has the attributes. He gave up the independent use of them and only could use them as God allowed it. And it was clear, it had to be made clear to his humanity, okay, you can do this. He limited himself to the voluntary non-use of the attributes. He abandoned some substantial measure of independence in the use. That one's vague, but you know, it's a view, so I have to put it in here. Whatever that means, he gave up some substantial measure of independence. F, he had a human soul to which the Logos imparted his divinity little by little until Jesus became completely divine. That one's wrong. Again, some of them I'll point out, you know, you can just mark beside them true, false, whatever, however you want to do it, right, wrong, I don't care. G, he laid aside his deity, which was then restored at the ascension, wrong. H, he abandoned certain prerogatives of the divine mode of existence in order to assume the human, true to a point. I, he lived a double life from two non-communicating life centers. As God, he continued his Trinitarian and providential existence. And as man, he was united as a human nature, or he had a human nature. He did not know consciously anything of his divine Trinitarian existence. That's incorrect. He spoke, you could tell when he spoke sometimes, he was aware that he was deity. I mean, he used the title of deity, I am, over and over and over again. I am. I am the light of the world. Unless you believe that I am, you will die in your sins. So Jesus asserted his deity. I and the Father are one. He asserted his deity repeatedly. So was he conscious of it? Well, if he said it, I'm presuming he was conscious of it. I mean, not that we've never said anything and not been conscious of it, but I don't attribute that to Jesus. That if he said it, he was conscious of it. So kenosis here means that the divine Son actually laid aside his prerogatives as God, gave up the outward expression as God, and gave up the independent use of the divine attributes during the incarnation. So when Satan comes to Jesus and he says, if you're the Son of God, command that these stones be made bread. Well, then Jesus has to ask himself, as it were, or his humanity has to figure out, is it the will of God for me to turn these stones into bread? Now, he's got the power to do it. So power is not the issue. The question is it the will of God? And in this case, no, it's a temptation from Satan, and that is not the will of God. And, you know, most of us can logically, a baby believers can figure that one out. So to attribute that knowledge to the Son of God, to me, wasn't difficult. So we recognize, you know, what we know and what we don't know. And so anyway, he gave up the independent exercise. 13, the hypostatic union view recognizes that God, that the Son, was still very God of very God. The Nicene Creed, which was designed to combat the Arian heresy, this was Arius, who asserted that the Son was created. And there are isolated verses you can point to in the Bible and try to prove that the Son was a created being. Verses like the firstborn of all creation. That makes it sound like he was created himself. He was not. As God, he could not be created. That this is, he's still God, but he chose to be united with finite flesh in order to fulfill the will of the Father. Thus, he was fully human and fully divine. John 5:30. And that view, of course, is correct. He was fully human and fully divine. But this gets into the hard issues theologically of what is the relationship between these two natures, one infinite, one finite. What is the relationship between omniscience and human knowledge? Between omnipresence and human power? Well, there's a huge gap there, no question. Same with omniscience, really. John 5:30, I can do nothing on my own initiative. As I hear, I judge. And my judgment is just, because I do not seek my own will, but I seek the will of him who sent me. And my own will it could not be deity, because in his deity, he agrees with God. He is God. So he has to be talking at some level here from his humanity. That in his humanity, I do the will of the Father, the one who sent me. But the one who sent me is true of both his deity and his humanity. He was sent, obviously, in his deity to join in this hypostatic union with finite flesh. So, therefore, point 14, when Christ spoke from his deity, he spoke as God. But when he spoke from his humanity, he was subject to the same human limitations that normal humans are. And he spoke accordingly. For instance, John, well, actually, our time is up. We'll look at these verses on Tuesday. We'll go ahead and stop right here. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the pleasure of fellowshipping in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.